At BP, we've reset our strategy with a focused downstream, a growing upstream, and disciplined investment in the transition. See how we'll grow shareholder value at bp.com/reset.
Sometimes it feels like the world is moving at hyperspeed and you can't keep up because it's one thing, then another, and don't forget the meeting and the yoga class and the dinner reservation, but then you get into the all-new Nissan Murano, and you feel the breeze from the panoramic moonroof, while the massaging seats melt away the tension of the day. And you realize that sometimes the greatest rush is not rushing at all. Shop the all-new Murano at NissanUSA.com. Panoramic moonroof, massaging leather-appointed seats are available features.
Women to Watch is an intimate look into the lives of prominent and influential women leaders from around the world and the challenges they faced on their journey. It's the real story behind her title. Join us every week to hear more stories about women from around the world and in your own communities at womentowatch.net. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another week of Women to Watch. I'm Sue Rocco. Thanks so much for being with me. Joining me in just a moment will be Lindsay Scrace. And Lindsay is the Chief Operations Officer for Checker, which is a technology company that does background checks. I invite you always to visit our YouTube channel at W2W Media and subscribe if you'd like to watch the show rather than listening into the podcast. And lastly, I'd love for you to sign up for our monthly newsletter where you can hear all things about the show and our lineup at womentowatch.net, N-E-T. So now I'm very honored to welcome to the show, Lindsay Scrace. Lindsay Scrace, welcome to the show.
Thank you. So good to be here.
It's so great to have you. You have a really cool job. I think as the Chief Operations Officer at Checker, which for those who don't know, is a technology company for background checks. I would imagine lots of things are fluid. I mean, just changing all the time. And we're going to get into your role there, but I want to talk a little bit about the little Lindsay growing up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, yes. Which I've never been to, but it sounds beautiful.
It's a lovely place. Yes.
Yeah. Can you just talk about the neighborhood or community that you grew up in there?
Yeah. So, I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, which Ann Arbor is about 45 minutes outside of Detroit, a college town where the University of Michigan is based. So really, like I would say 100,000 people roughly. So smallish town, very diverse, which was a really amazing experience to grow up from all like religion, race, socioeconomic status. And I grew up there, went through public school in Ann Arbor. And then also actually went to the University of Michigan myself for undergrad. A really great place to grow up. Kind of like a gem in the Midwest, as I think it's written about on many websites.
And am I right? You have two older brothers?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so you're the baby of two older brothers. Did that influence any of your, trying to keep up with them, needing any attention?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, absolutely. So, I have two older brothers. And I looked up to them a lot. And also we were very competitive. So I wanted to be able to do everything they did. I didn't want differential treatment because I was a girl, and my parents actually did a really good job. They treated us very equally in terms of expectations, in terms of capabilities. And we did a lot of like games, board games, card games, sports games. And I was always there, right there with them and really wanted to do as much, if not more, than they were doing at any given age, despite them, like one of them being 4 years older than I am.
Oh, okay. And I know your father was a doctor and your mom was able to be home with you. Was there ever a thought of going into medicine?
It was interesting. Yeah. My dad, he was a doctor and he worked a lot. He was on call a lot. He was gone a lot. And I think reflecting on it, I wanted to avoid that. You know, I guess I didn't know what that meant exactly. You know, I think it's very different depending on every doctor's circumstance, but I really liked people. I liked math and science. And so I think at one point I thought about being an engineer, but wasn't enough people interaction. So I derivated and went into business. But I think looking back, I think I would have enjoyed medicine as well. I think that it, you know, it combines two of what I think are my strengths. And I mean, he's a phenomenal doctor, but I wanted to kind of chart my own course and do my own thing.
Yeah. Do you remember what your first job was? Did you get a job as a teenager?
Yes. Yes. So I worked as soon as I was legal age to work. I did like paper routes and things like that before babysitting. But then my first job was working at Wendy's. There was one right down the street from where we lived. And I started working there, I guess, when I was in freshman year of high school. And I worked every single Saturday and Sunday at 7 a.m. like for 8 hours, 8 hour shifts.
Wow.
In high school. I'm a very loyal employee. So I stayed here. I think we had a big focus from my family was on independence. And so my parents, you know, we were a middle-class family, but you know, they said, if you want to have a car to get around in, which in Ann Arbor, you really do for school and for sports activities and whatnot, then you need to make enough money to pay for half of whatever you get. So I was very motivated on that and worked as much as possible. And I think work was a big part of my you know, identity from a young age and has obviously continued. And I like working. I really enjoy it.
Yeah, I think that mine first was at McDonald's.
Oh, so wow.
A similar experience. And I just remember feeling like such a grown up having a job, even though it was in a fast food restaurant. You learn, you know, to show up, responsibility, dealing with customers. So it's a great background.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So tell me, when you decided to go to the University of Michigan, what were your aspirations at that time? Did you have a sense of, you know, this is what I want to pursue, this is what I want to be when I grow up?
I had no idea. Frankly, I've never been a person who's got a long-term plan from a career perspective. I kind of, I would say, follow a mix of common sense and then my intuition and my internal compass, which has guided me throughout my entire life. And so I think going to Michigan was, you know, a pragmatic option. It was in-state. It was a good school, but I had no idea what I wanted to do. So I was taking a lot of classes and kind of exploring things. And as I mentioned, I really was always very good at math, loved math. And so I started taking, sciences classes, computer science, engineering classes, and liked that. But I just didn't want to sit and code, by myself. And I wanted something more interactive. I remember taking economics classes and loved it. And then someone mentioned to me that there's an undergraduate business program for your junior and senior year at Michigan. I think my brother, actually, one of my brothers was like, this is one of the best in the country. You should apply. And so, you know, on a whim, I applied and I got in and I loved the business curriculum. I loved this mix of a lot of quantitative thinking, but with you have to in business be a strong leader, a strong communicator. You have to work together to get things done. And I love that combination of the two things. So I joined that business program, which kind of set the course for where I headed from there.
Were there a lot of girls in your class at the time?
No. I mean, it was, I would say maybe 25% women. 25%. That's a guess. 25, maybe 30, maybe a third to a third. Better than
how did you maneuver that? Yeah. Did you care? Maybe you didn't, it didn't even bother you.
I care. I mean, I care a lot about diversity generally. When I was looking at colleges as well, that was a lens with which I used. Growing up in Ann Arbor shaped me a lot in that aspect. But I did know when I was in the computer science classes, being, I think, one of only two girls in the class really bothered me. And so comparatively, the business school, it wasn't as bad as it was in other parts of the university. And so it wasn't a flag for me at that time. Once I went into the workforce, it was way more stark in terms of men versus women. But in the business school, I mean, a third roughly wasn't out of the realm of normal for me at that point.
I think this is such an interesting part of your life story is upon graduation, you went abroad to work for a shipping company. Can you tell our viewers that story and how that opportunity came to you?
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, maybe just rewinding a little bit before then, as I mentioned, I've always done my own thing based on what feels right to me, and within reason, obviously. But for the all throughout college, especially in the business school, the normal path is, you know, often an internship at a bank or a consulting firm. That was probably the most common. And instead of doing that, I sold books door to door in California for the first summer, kind of you running your own business, learning sales. Then I ran a painting franchise the next summer, and then I ran like a set of branches of painting franchises, my last one. So I did very different things and got a really rich experience in business and in running my own company in a lot of ways. Obviously, it was in like a framework that it was like through kind of a program in college. But so coming out of that, I had a lot of good experience and was thinking about what I wanted to do. And I knew I liked kind of a more general manager type experience where I wasn't kind of pigeonholed into one specific function, because I liked kind of doing that in those experiences before. And then I knew very deeply, very clearly that I wanted experiences abroad. Like that was something that I was always excited about, passionate about. And we only traveled to Mexico as a family. So I hadn't been abroad, but I really wanted to. And so I was looking and I thought, you know, one angle was consulting. And so I was interviewing with those firms, got an offer to go into consulting, which was very, very common, a really exciting path. But then this company called Maersk, a Danish company, was recruiting on campus. And this program, they hire 300 people from 90 different countries. They put you through an intensive program, kind of general manager type curriculum where you do every function. And then you learn a new language, you go abroad. And that was like,
that was exactly what you were looking for. Yeah. Something different and abroad.
Yeah, I wasn't looking for shipping, but I also wasn't looking for painting. So I ran at it, and it was an amazing experience.
Tell me what, you know, your fondest memory. I mean, there's obviously that was, you know, a full and rich experience and learning another language. But do you have one very fond memory that stays with you?
I mean, I think I spent lots of time in Denmark. I moved to the Netherlands in Europe, and I just remember moving there, not knowing anyone, and arriving and just feeling completely overwhelmed. I was crying. I'm like, what did I do? I had a really great life and friends and back in the US, and it was you know, at least a 2-year commitment.
2 years. Oh, I didn't realize. I thought it was just a year, and no classmates of yours went with you.
Yeah, that's gutsy. Yeah, but it was what I wanted. But I think that the first several months were really hard. And I think that, you know, you're in a new job, you're in a new country, everything's new. And, but it was like persevering through that was so rewarding and just gave me that confidence in myself of, you know, like taking that road less traveled or listening to my inner compass, my inner voice will serve me well, even if it's hard at first. And that's just kind of stayed with me throughout my life. And, you know, I traveled through that time to over, I think, 50 countries. Like I've seen the world. It was such an amazing experience. So I think the overarching experience for me was probably the most rewarding, and then a lot of good memories across the board.
Tell me, I had written down, you mentioned you're really following that inner voice and this that you really, which I think is what we all should do, right? Mm-hmm. When did you discover that? When did you have the confidence to do that as opposed to looking outward to what other people were doing or telling you should do?
I mean, I would say the confidence continues to grow. You still have those moments. I still do when I have doubts. But I think that doubting voice has gotten smaller and smaller over the years. I think that decision it was like the series of decisions, like the decision to not follow everyone else and what they were doing. I realized as I went through this experience at Maersk, which everyone thought was somewhat odd, but I I loved it, but I got such a good working experience. I was a director for all of the Americas when I left, and I had, you know, tremendous experience, and that set me up well for the next thing. So I think going through that really solidified for me that I should continue to just trust my instincts. But I had the same questions. I got an MBA. When I went out, I went a little bit of a different path. I left Google to my job now, which was a non-traditional path. So every time I question, but I that like voice gets smaller and smaller, and my instincts, I'm more and more confident in them.
That's awesome. Just think some of the best advice. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about your time at Google, a company many young kids coming out of school want to go work for.
Yes.
Stay with us as we go into the break, and we'll be back with Lindsay Scrace.
Sometimes it feels like the world is moving at hyperspeed and you can't keep up because it's one thing, then another, and don't forget the meeting and the yoga class and the dinner reservation, but then you get into the all-new Nissan Murano and you feel the breeze from the panoramic moonroof while the massaging seats melt away the tension of the day. And you realize that sometimes the greatest rush is not rushing at all. Shop the all-new Murano at NissanUSA.com. Panoramic moonroof, massaging leather appointed seats are available features.
As a female-led organization, you have to bring it every single day. We're a mashup of sort of right and left brain. So we're not just doing management consulting. We're not just doing creative services. We're not just producing an event, but we're bringing a comprehensive solution to our clients. And because of the way we approach it, we end up being bought into what it is that we're doing in a way that we truly have as much skin in the game as our clients do, whether it's bringing affordable internet to communities across the Caribbean, or it's helping Comcast with their Internet Essentials program, which is something we've been very proud to work on, or it's helping the NFL celebrate their centennial season by getting 1 million people to give at least 100 minutes to causes they care about, or helping the city of Philadelphia win the World Cup. So what's next for us? Well, we just hit just over 100 employees. I think we are at that tipping point, and I don't think there's anybody that does it better than we do. I'm Maggie Wilkinson, CEO of Athena Global Advisors, a company that is proudly based in Philadelphia.
Hi, I'm Katie Gore, the president of Quidel Consulting and Training. There are a lot of myths about affordable housing and the people who need and live in affordable housing. One myth, for example, only people who are unemployed need and live in affordable housing. The reality is that many people in affordable housing actually have working full-time jobs. Teachers, healthcare workers, service employees, people who are essential in our communities. They often struggle to afford rent in so many communities across the nation. And that's what's the beauty about affordable housing. They are providing work in the communities at an affordable rent. Another myth is that affordable housing increases crime. Studies consistently show there is no link between affordable housing and increased crime. In fact, stable housing can reduce crime by providing security and fostering stronger community neighborhoods and building attachment for the people who live in affordable housing. For more information about affordable housing and to walk through some more of those myths, you can find me and my segment on the Women to Watch platform.
Hi, and welcome back to the show. If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Lindsay Scrace, and Lindsay is the COO of Checker, which is a tech company serving background checks for personal, corporate, and criminal. And we'll be talking more about that because I have a lot of questions about how that works. But you did spend 10 years, I believe, at Google.
Yeah.
Which is a company, I think, you know, it's up there for people in tech who want to go get some great experience. But one of the things you were involved in there was really trying to advance equity and diversity within the company. Tell me, you know, how you went about that and what some of the initiatives were that you were involved in.
Yeah, I mean, Google as a whole kind of identified that to continue to get the best talent in, there needed to be representation. We needed to make sure that we were looking in all areas in terms of recruiting for the best talent, not just maybe the traditional channels and schools. I mean, when Google started, I think you had to be from like one of 5 to 10 schools to get a job or an internship. And
oh, really? Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and I think that there was a recognition over time that like they were just missing out on a lot of people. So Google as a whole kind of took that direction. And for me, when building the, you know, I started at Google in a kind of small department. Now it's called Google Cloud, but at the time it was a few hundred people. And now it's tens of billions in revenue. So it grew a ton over the 10 years I was there. But when I was building my organizations and scaling, I wanted to make sure that, you know, we're hiring the best candidates, but really making sure we're looking in all the right places. And I focused on making sure that we're, you know, interviewing people from a lot of different backgrounds. I was very focused on also being visible in a lot of different dimensions of my identity, which I think gave a lot of opportunity for others. So I'm a woman, and I think early in my career, I felt like I need to fit in with the men. I need to maybe like the things they like and do those things. And I learned I'm going to be my authentic self and be proud of that. As a mom as well, I never worked for a woman for the first, I think, almost 20 years of my career. I never had a woman above me.
Wow.
And then I worked for one, kind of toward the tail end of my time at Google, and she was a mom. And I'm like, it was revolutionary to me because I was, you know, early mom. I was like, how does one do this? You know, be a mom and a tech executive and, you know, manage all the things. And so, so I talked a lot about being a mom and just made sure that there was awareness when I interviewed people. I just talked about it and just normalized that a little bit. And then I'm a member of the LGBTQ community. I have a wife, and it's a hidden identity unless I make it visible. And so I'm also always very out proactively. And that I've seen has just made huge impact for people who don't necessarily feel that they can be their authentic self, and giving them that that like license and liberty to be out and to be comfortable with it. That's something that, you know, I think when you're in a position of power and in privilege, I care deeply about, you know, providing that representation in all the dimensions that I can.
Yeah. I have a quote. We'll jump ahead, leaving Google. You said, my decision to join Checkr was based on my belief in their mission to use technology to improve equity and access to work. Mm-hmm. How are they doing that?
Yeah. So, I mean, Checkr, just to give the quick highlight of for those who aren't familiar with Checkr, but we do background checks, as you mentioned, and we do that with technology that makes it way faster, less manual, less error prone. So that's kind of the product and what we offer. We also, you know, as our founder, you know, was starting the company and talking to people, calling in, asking about their background check, and he became aware of how many people are being screened out of the workforce because they have a conviction or arrest record. So 1 in 3 adult Americans, 1 in 3 has an arrest record or conviction. And
really, 1 in 3.
Yeah.
Wow.
So huge part of our workforce is being screened out for employment, and that just creates more and more societal problems. It increases recidivism, people going back to prison. And so at Checkr, we invest in what's called the 1% pledge, where we invest 1% of our profits or time or product into a cause. And ours is fair chance or second chance hiring. So hiring for those who have a record. And we do that in a lot of ways, by hiring people ourselves, by investing in areas in the product that allow you, when you're making a hiring decision, to assess, you know, maybe this marijuana charge from this time period is not relevant for this job, or this DUI, they're not driving a car in this job. Maybe this is not relevant. And it's each company decides on their own. We're not giving, you know, advice. Everyone has their own situation, but just driving awareness of this is really important. And I take a lot of pride that we are helping advance that at Trekker.
Yeah. Everyone deserves a second chance, right? They say that. And also there's so many different levels of crime, you know,
None of us have to be defined for the rest of our lives for the worst decision.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Can you tell me what your day to day looks like? Besides doing interviews?
My day starts at home and getting the kids.
The kids. How old are they?
They're 5 and 7.
Okay.
And my wife is also an executive and busy role as well. So I try to get up extra before them and get exercise in to set me for the day appropriately, get them ready and then head into the office. And then my work day, it really varies depending on what is going on. But I would say the bulk of my time is on working with our executive team on strategy and direction for the company, working with customers to help solve their problems, and then working with the team to help unblock issues that they may have. And so that's a lot of meetings, a lot of problem solving, and a lot of fun. Like I mean, there's never a dull moment. When I was going to Trekker, someone said to me, you know, moving from a big company like a Google to a smaller startup, I mean, Trekker is a larger startup at this point, but is that you're, you know, in a big company, you're kind of like on a bus that's moving, you play a really important role, but you're not feeling every bump in the road. And then at a startup, you're like driving a race car. So you're feeling all the ups.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
One wrong turn could send you in a really bad direction. And so I'm loving it. I think it's learning so much, and just the people I work with are absolutely amazing. And the customers are incredible.
Do you find it? So technology itself is continually changing and, you know, getting better, you know, sometimes on a weekly basis, you might implement something and then there's a better way to do it. Is that exciting for you, or can it be stressful?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's exciting. I mean, I think you have to frame it the right way. Right. And I had a boss at Google once, and Google was amazing at this. It was like fail, iterate, and fail fast. So don't try to launch something perfectly, but like try something and then improve upon it later. They said to me, "Said Lindsay, if you're not disrupting your own job, then someone else will disrupt it for you. So you have to keep thinking about what's the next way of doing things." And AI, you know, we're in a totally new chapter right now, and every company's figuring out like how to use AI for your productivity, for your product engagement with customers. And I think it's exciting, but you have to be intentional about leaning in versus leaning out, I would say.
Yeah. And I assume you're already using that in your product, AI?
Yeah. Our product has had AI integrated for quite some time, and we're rolling out a lot of new features to help improve comprehensiveness and accuracy and speed. And then we're also using a lot of it internally just to be more productive, you know. And there's just, I think the thing with this is like what you think might not be possible a month ago is going to be possible in 3 months. And so we're challenging the company and ourselves to make sure we're continuing to look and, you know, to set stretch goals so that we don't kind of rest on our laurels, and we're leaning in to figure out how to use this new ever evolving technology.
Yeah. Outside of your role with Trekker, you're also an investor in startups. And I wonder what you're seeing for women in startups. Are you seeing it seems to me as though a lot more women are starting their own businesses today than they did even 10 years ago.
Yes, which is so exciting to see. And there's more and more female founder focused funds for investing in female founders. But it's still hard. I mean, the venture landscape where most of these startups get funded is mostly men. And there's just, you know, there's unconscious bias that everyone has to work against. But I'm a member of a fund where is it solely investing in female founders, and that's really rewarding to see. And I've helped advise for several of them as well. And just the like I'd say there was a post COVID and a slowdown in startups, and now it's just accelerating, especially with the kind of unlock of generative AI. And it's been really cool. I mean, the jury's out. There's so many things out there, but we'll see what is successful and what is not, but a lot of great ideas.
I think it's important that we have more women involved in, you know, the innovation around technology and AI. I assume you agree with me. And I wondered, how would you describe how women are different and how they problem solve, and why? Why do we need more women in technology? What is your view on that?
I think that I would say two things. One is that when like innovations are being developed, they're serving, you know, they're serving everyone, you know, ideally everyone on the planet, if you're trying to build a really great business, and not just men. And so you really want to think about having diversity in the development of products and thinking such that you're able to represent the potential customers and users. That's one really important reason. I think another is that to get the best talent, you can't just draw from 50% of the workforce. Like that's just not going to work. And like, you know, representation matters to be able to recruit, you know, that other half of the workforce. And so it's a little bit of chicken and egg problem. And then in terms of like how women operate versus men, I mean, I think just like any aspect of diversity brings, you know, there's just all the data shows that the more diverse team you have, the better outcome you get. And so, you know, that's just a critical component of it.
Yeah. More ideas, right? Yeah. Different ideas.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. You mentioned your wife and your two children, and I wanted to ask you, do you have in your mothering, your parenting, a mantra that you continually use with your kids, something that you say to them on a regular basis?
One thing I've been talking to my daughter about lately a lot is this like notion of your learning zone versus danger zone. And think about concentric circles, like in the middle is kind of where your comfort zone is. And then there's a stretched circle outside of that that is your learning zone. And then beyond that is maybe a danger zone of like, this feels too scary to me to try. And so I really encourage them, and I've been talking to her a lot about this, to get out of your comfort zone. And if you're not doing that, you're not learning and growing. And I think that's been, whether it's like trying a new sport or, you know, spending time with a new friend, like these are 7-year-old problems. But I think that's been really important to me in my life. And we talked about some of those themes earlier. And I think that sometimes people get tripped up that you're like, this is too scary for me, or pushing themselves too far out of their comfort zone, where it's like, hey, that's not authentic to you. And so finding that middle ground is something that we're really focused on with them. I want them to experience challenge and adversity and grow and learn and then follow their instincts while doing all of that.
Yeah, that's a tough concept for kids, because in one respect, we're telling them to be careful. I'm sure we just naturally, right? Be careful. You don't want them hurt physically or emotionally, but then trying to get them to understand to take chances.
It's so hard.
Yeah,
so hard.
That is hard.
Especially with our, like, you know, parents have just gotten more and more protective over their children since I was a kid, at least. And it's, I think at a certain point, there's like definitely diminishing returns or negative consequences from that.
Yeah. My last question, you know, if there's a woman watching that is perhaps wanting to take a step into the technology field, but feels she's more creative, what would you say to her? Because I think there are true creative aspects within the technology industry that people that haven't had that experience don't fully understand.
I mean, I would say that I think that we tend to be so quick as young folks to try to put ourselves in a box of like, I am a creative or I am technical.
And right brain, left brain.
Yeah. I think that so much, like some of that is true. Some of that's socialization. And so I would think rather, one, like creativity is essential in any tech job. Like no matter what you're doing, you're expected to be creative, to creatively problem solve. And I would say don't write off those jobs. And if you are trying to get into technology, I think it's really critical, like work hard, like continue learning, push, like none of that's going to be easy. And then like their hard work is required. But then also trust yourself, you know, and trust that your abilities and, you know, as I mentioned before, like push into that learning zone, out of your comfort zone a little bit. Don't stay in a box and assume it's not for you, or you're not going to be successful, or there's not the right role.
I actually have one more question.
Yeah.
One more. Because I wanted to ask you throughout your career, do you remember ever receiving advice that you thought that's the best advice I've ever heard? Something simple, you know, sometimes it's just something someone says to you in a conversation.
Yeah. I mean, I think that this is a little bit of a non-answer, but I think when I, growing up, you know, the youngest, I was more of an introverted kid, my very strong personalities in my family. And I didn't see myself as a leader necessarily. I mean, obviously like I'm determined. I want to control things, you know, there's probably like a lot of the instincts there that I didn't see in myself. But I think that as I went through, you know, I was field hockey and my coach kind of has, like my team voted me captain, or at Wendy's, I became a crew leader, or my first job at the shipping company, I got promoted to lead my peers. I think all those moments, I was just like really surprised. And I realized that other people were seeing things in me I didn't see in myself. And I think that the kind of implicit advice from those and one of the leaders at Maersk, the shipping company, said is like, you have to kind of let go of that self-doubt and just trust that you've got this, because it's a waste of time to spend kind of spiraling or having doubts on your capabilities, both from a personal perspective and like from your job. And so I think that was, you know, I don't have like a good quote or saying, but it was just, yeah, trust yourself. You got this.
Yeah. And there's a difference between our capabilities and perhaps a personality that's more on the quiet side. There's big personalities that tend to get more attention. And I think we often look and think they're doing a better job when it's really more about what you bring forth.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's great. Great way to end the show, Lindsay. Thank you so much for taking some time to join us.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Continued success.
Yeah. This is an amazing podcast. You're doing this and love being a part of it. Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to go into our last break and I'll be back to close out the show.
Over on our Women to Watch YouTube channel, we have a partner profile series featuring some of the amazing executive women working at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Our latest installment features Dr. Susan Firth. Here's an excerpt from our latest conversation. The goal, I would say, of CHOP is for every child to have a chance at a healthy future. And how does the Research Institute specifically support and help in that goal?
One of our strategic imperatives as an enterprise is to really promote research-driven precision medicine, you know, so diagnostics and therapeutics that are really tailored to an individual's circumstance. And I always add to that research-driven precision medicine that this has to be research-driven precision medicine for everyone. So we've invested in programs around health equity research methods and making sure that as we are pursuing our research and discovery, that we're thinking about how our questions apply to different populations, whether it's where they live, if they're rural or urban, or what their social determinants of health are. So we're trying to incorporate thinking broadly about improving child health to all populations. So we want to help children who are around the world and also in our backyard.
To learn more about Dr. Susan Firth, head over to our Women to Watch YouTube channel for the full interview.
We
are CHOP. And we can't wait to show you around. We're the nation's first children's hospital. Now, a care network with more than 50 locations that continues to expand. 3 state-of-the-art research buildings with 1.5 million square feet of space. We have grown from 12 beds 165 years ago to nearly 600 beds and one of the best children's hospitals in the world. We have a level 1 trauma center, 11 floors of patient units, more than 20 operating rooms, first-of-its-kind delivery unit for babies with birth defects, a separate cardiac operative and catheterization suite, and places to learn, like our internationally recognized simulation center. We have trained generations of leaders in the field of pediatrics. We are world leaders in medicine, surgery, and science. One of the top recipients in NIH funding for pediatric research. In this building, pioneers in CAR T therapy, mitochondrial disease, brain tumors, hyperinsulinism, and other rare diseases. Here, groundbreaking work in fetal surgery, genetics and genomics, and neurology. In our newest building, leaders in social determinants of health, clinical informatics and epidemiology, autism, trauma and injury prevention. Our patients come from every state and 115 countries. Meeting these challenges requires the best and the brightest. We are passionate about pediatrics. We are motivated to make a difference in the world and in our community. We are a team. We are CHOP.
Hi, I'm Dawn Zier, CEO, Board Director, and Executive Mentor to Fortune 500 executives through my work at the EXCO Group, a firm of experienced CEOs, board directors, and global business leaders who offer real-world experience to help organizations and senior executives grow. At some point early on in your life, you've likely been asked, what do you want to be when you grow up? Some of us know right away, but most of us don't know exactly what we want to do and change our mind multiple times throughout our lives. And that's perfectly okay. Take me, for example. When I look at my career, it's been a non-linear journey and chock full of reinventions. First, I was an engineer, then I switched to marketing. I worked at a phone company, a bank, ran international for a media company, became a CEO of a health and wellness company, and now serve on multiple boards across various industries. Which brings me to one of the biggest lessons I've learned. For many successful people, their career is not a straight line. Let each chapter, each role inform the next, and don't be afraid to pivot. Also, remember that one often needs to make lateral moves rather than take a promotion to prepare for upward mobility. No experience is wasted, and every position you find yourself in is an opportunity to learn, to figure out what you want to do, and perhaps even more importantly, what you don't want to do, and also to define where your true passion lies. Please follow me on LinkedIn at Dawn Zier. And if you're a senior executive looking to grow in your career, visit excoleadership.com to learn more.
That's it, everyone, for another week of Women to Watch. Thanks for tuning in. Next week, I will be sitting down with Shika Maglani, and Shika is the founder of Saharte. Thank you, as always, to our sponsors and our Watch Team members for their contributions to the show and for helping us to bring you these stories each and every week. I'll see you next time.